this morning. So this is a conversion story. But it's not what you think. Down through the years, the Bible's been a rich source of stories for Hollywood to dramatize, correct? The Ten Commandments, the Prince of Egypt, the Passion of the Christ, Noah. I mean, we can think of all kinds of movies that have been made out of stories of the Bible. But I don't know that anyone has ever attempted to make a big budget movie out of what I believe is one of the most dramatic scenes in the whole Bible. And that's our story today. The conversion of Saul, who becomes Paul, on the road to Damascus. I mean, wouldn't this make a great movie? I mean, can you picture it? Paul, probably played by, you know, Russell Crowe or Brad Pitt, starts out as this anti-Christian bad guy, and we see him going and arresting Christians and being mean to him and torturing him, really sets him up as the antagonist to the story. But then it's sort of this spectacular moment. Paul's riding his donkey to Jerusalem or to Damascus when, cue the CGI special effects, the bright light shines down on him. Then Jesus, voiced, of course, by James Earl Jones, says, "Paul, Paul, why do you persecute me?" I mean, wouldn't that throw in a love story and an explosion, a couple chariot chases? I'd pay $9 for that, right? This story deserves this kind of spectacular telling because it plays the most pivotal role in the history of the church. In fact, I would argue that it is second to the resurrection in importance of the church. Because if Paul doesn't get converted, he never goes on his journeys to spread the good news. So this is a pivotal moment in Scripture. We're first introduced to Paul at the stoning of Stephen, which was in chapter 8. Stephen was a Christ follower who was trying to spread the good news. He's arrested. He makes his testimony of what he's doing, and he's sentenced to death. So Luke tells us that Saul and Paul, interchangeable names, was there, and he gave approval for Stephen's execution. The end of chapter 8 says this, On that day a great persecution broke out against the church at Jerusalem, and all except the apostles were scattered throughout Judea and Samaria. Godly men buried Stephen and mourned deeply for him, but Saul began to destroy the church. Going from house to house, he dragged off men and women and put them in prison. And why haven't we learned from history that people do those things in the name of religion? This isn't anything new to us, unfortunately. So Saul, we know he was a Pharisee. He was a zealous follower of the Jewish faith. He had it fixed in his mind that if someone didn't believe the way he believed, they were wrong. And not only were they wrong, they deserved to be punished and locked up and persecuted and even stoned to death. He felt it was his personal job to say to people who were claiming Jesus was the Messiah, "You are wrong and I am right." And he's so fervent in his faith, he's willing to travel a week to Damascus to arrest more Christians, to make sure that this dangerous fringe movement didn't undermine his beloved Judaism. You hear the closed-mindedness, the elitism that's there. So Paul goes to Damascus to arrest Christians, but instead it's Jesus who arrests Paul. This flash of light, this booming voice, and suddenly, in an instant, the one who was Saul, the Christian persecutor, becomes Paul, the Christian missionary. And although Luke never intends this to be the case when we think about it, Paul's conversion scene on the road to Damascus sort of became the blueprint for how people were supposed to come to faith. In fact, for centuries, sort of a recitation of your conversion experience was often your ticket into the church or your value of religious legitimacy. You had to have a conversion experience in order to be considered a true believer. Well, I was living in Chicago, used to play basketball at a local church there on Fridays with a group of pastors from that church. It's an evangelical church, more conservative than the one I served. I enjoyed the camaraderie with the guys. It was fun to get out and play some hoops, but I tried to avoid any religious discussions with them. We were pretty far apart theologically, and I didn't want to go down that road with them. Well, one day after we finished, we were sitting on the bleachers, and one of the pastors comes up to me, and he's asked me about my spiritual journey. And I tried to steer the conversation away from that because I knew where it was going, but before I could block his religious shot, he said, "So tell me your story. Tell me your story." And I started, "Well, I was born in 1907 Jefferson." No. "When were you saved?" In other words, he wanted to hear my Damascus Road experience. Here's the thing. I don't have one. I don't have one. Never saw the bright light. Never heard the James Earl Jones voice. If you ask me, Paul had it easy. I wish I had that. Because Paul gets proof and then has faith. Wouldn't that be nice? Because for all of us, it is we have faith and then we look for proof. I mean, Jesus spoke to him and he's like, hey, I'm real, believe in me. Oh man, why isn't it that easy for us? Most of us come to faith and then we spend our lives looking for that proof, that evidence. And I can't point to an exact day and time when I went from an unbeliever to a believer. I mean, there have been times where my faith has waffled, where my doubts have been stronger than my certainty, but I don't remember a time in my life where I didn't believe. Because if a dramatic conversion were a requirement to be a member of a church, how many of us would be here? I can't give a day and time I started believing because I don't know that I've ever stopped believing. It was just, faith was just there. It was a part of the fabric of my DNA, of my upbringing. So I don't have a before story like Paul does. I know some of us do. I mean, some of us have that sense of conversion, that before and after, and I think that's wonderful. That's fine, but it's not the only way we come to faith, right? Not all of us can point to a day and time and say, that's when I became a believer. So then what do we do with a story like Paul's? How do we make sense of it if this is not how we've experienced Christ working in our lives? I have relatives who live in Wilmington, North Carolina, which during the 1980s was a very popular place to film movies. Dino De Laurentiis, a Hollywood movie producer, put in a studio there. And so a lot of movies during the 80s were filmed in Wilmington, North Carolina. In fact, my step-grandmother at the time, we called her Mom-Mom. Mom-Mom got a small part in one of the films being filmed there. The movie was Firestarter, based on a Stephen King book, starring David Keith and a very young Drew Barrymore. If you haven't seen it, don't worry about it. It's not that good. Read the book. The book's much better. But she was in the movie. So on opening day, my family got in the car and we drove to the movie theater because we could not wait to see Mom in a movie. She was going to be a movie star. So I was on the edge of my seat during the whole movie just watching for her 30-foot face to appear upon the screen and go, hey, I know her. Well, the movie ends and I didn't see her. So I turned to my stepfather. I'm like, hey, where was Mom? And he's like, you didn't see her? I'm like, no. She wasn't in the movie. He's like, yeah, she was. She's like, you remember the big chase scene at the beginning when they're running down the sidewalk? I'm like, yeah. He's like, well, she was lady in the yellow dress that got shoved into the garbage can. I thought she was going to be like a big movie star. Instead, she was just like an extra in the story. So if Paul is the movie star in our story today, Ananias is like Jewish peasant number three, right? He really is a bit player in this. So Paul is struck blind. He's sent to Damascus, said, wait for further instructions. And God comes to Ananias. We know nothing about him. He just shows up in the story. And God says to Ananias, go see a man named Saul from Tarsus. Lay hands on him and restore his sight. I hope you catch the humor here. Because Ananias is no dummy. He's read the papers. He's heard the water cooler talk. He knows exactly who Saul is. And he knows exactly what Saul has been doing. In fact, Ananias may have had a brother or a cousin who had already been arrested by Saul, who had already been persecuted by Saul. You know those moments when you're like, God, you want me to do what? This is one of those what moments for Ananias. So imagine in his head when God says, I want you to go lay hands on Paul, he's probably thinking, oh yeah, I'm going to lay hands on him all right. Because it's one thing to love Jesus, but it's a whole other thing to love the people Jesus loves. That's not something we always bargain for. But Ananias is obedient in his faith, even though he's like, so, God, you want me to go to this guy who's been arresting everybody? God's like, yeah. So he goes to this persecutor of the Christians, and he greets him, did you catch it? As Brother Saul. Brother Saul. How would you react if you were called to go and extend hospitality to someone you considered an enemy? To someone with whom you were at odds? To someone you were afraid of? See, this faith stuff is fun when we sit in the sanctuary and talk about it, But what about when you are confronted with sharing the good news? I read an article recently about a church that was struggling with an issue similar to what Ananias struggled with. A man had started attending worship at that church, wanted to join the church, had started to get involved, but he revealed to those in the church that he had recently been released from prison. And he was convicted pedophile, seeking forgiveness and a new start. What do you do as a church there? I mean, I know what we should do, because I know what Jesus would do, but what would we do? Someone you love and respect posts something controversial or divisive on social media. You think, gosh, I thought I knew that person, but they posted that? What do you do with that? How do you handle that? What do you do when the line between an ally and an enemy, the enemy, gets blurred in that way? I mean, someone else in Ananias' place may have sought vengeance on Saul. He was blind. He hadn't eaten. He was vulnerable. You could end that right now. You could destroy the enemy. But while we might wish for destruction, God works towards transformation. I told you this is a conversion story, right? But I wasn't talking about Paul. I mean, yeah, he's converted, right? The most supernatural of ways. But that's not usually how it happens. Because I wonder who had the most dramatic conversion in the story. Was it Paul, who went from persecuting those who called on the name of the Lord to calling on the name of the Lord himself? Or was the more dramatic conversion Ananias, who was able to lay healing hands on the man who had come to arrest him? So I don't believe this story is lifted up as this is how you're supposed to come to faith. And I'm sure each of us could tell a unique story about our faith journey. Even if it's not completed yet. And honestly, it's not completed for any of us yet, right? God works in a variety of ways to bring people to faith. So what we need to recognize is that conversion is not a one-shot divine zap. No one has a before and after story. We all have a becoming story. Because every day we are called to be converted to who Christ has called us to be. Every day when we wake up, we are converted by God and we are called to go and be the good news to people, even to people that we don't even like. Every day we are called to speak a word of peace, to speak a word of justice, to speak a word of forgiveness to people who need to hear those words the most. We never become so wise or so good at faith that our conversion stops. It's an ongoing process where each day we are converted to be a little bit less like who we were and a little bit more like who Christ calls us to be, an instrument of peace in this volatile world. So I don't think it matters how we come to faith. We all come to faith in different ways. Maybe you have a dramatic before and after story like Paul, or maybe your faith has grown like a petal by petal opening of a flower. Some conversions are revolutionary. Some take a lifetime to happen. Doesn't matter. What matters is what you do with that conversion, what you do with this transformation that God is offering you. Because the lasting mark of conversion is not circling some date on a calendar saying, that's when I came to Christ. The mark of conversion is your whole life. It's the whole story of how you live that out. And the evidence of conversion is not a fish bumper sticker on your car. The evidence of conversion is a changed life. How are you different now that you call on the name of the Lord? Paul's conversion just had to be a little more public than most people's. But for me, it's Ananias who sets the realistic example because he's not some spectacular Christian. We never hear him teach or preach or proclaim the gospel. In fact, we never hear from him again. This is the only time he is mentioned in the entirety of the Bible. He's just a bit player in this drama. Maybe like you and me. But it's his courage that allows Paul to start his new life. Ananias may have just been an extra, but Christ nudges him to work alongside him. And the interesting thing I find about the story is that both the conversion of Paul and the conversion of Ananias include a call to be lived out, right? So conversion isn't a passive event. It's something active that demands, that compels a response from us. For Paul, he is called to preach the word of Christ to the world. And for Ananias, he is called to preach the word of Christ to Paul. Some among us may be like Paul, called to spread the good news far and wide. But my guess is most of us are probably like Ananias, called to make a difference in the life of maybe one other person. For you, someone was your Ananias. Someone told you about the good news. Someone showed you what it was like to be loved by God. Who helped open your eyes? And to whom are you being called to be an Ananias? To whom is God nudging you to extend God's grace, to call them brother or sister? Because I believe we all can be Ananias to someone else. So my prayer for us is that we are converted each and every day. That each and every day we take one step closer to Christ, which usually means one step further from our comfort zone. So that's the challenge we have to face. If we want to become more like Christ, it usually means moving further and further away from passivity and comfort. May we have the faith to trust in God's leading. May we have the courage to call someone brother and sister, even when they may be calling us names that aren't nearly as nice as that. Because this faith stuff, man, this is not easy. Thanks be to God.